I'm your host, Juliet, and I'm here with my co-host, Teresa.
Hi.
And you're listening to Mind the Gap. Mind the Gap is a podcast dedicated to discovering the minds behind health, rehabilitation, and neuroscience researchers. So sit back, relax, and please, mind the gap. So today we are switching things up with a fun new episode. I have invited Kyle, a man that I met on the streets, apparently he rock climbs, to answer some basic neuroscience questions. Kyle, do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, I'm Kyle. I rock climb. I play Spirit Island quite a lot. And I also picked up a bachelor's in science with a major in marine biology.
Okay, so Kyle, do you have any background information in neuroscience? Like, did you take any neuroscience courses or anything?
I took first year psych.
Okay. That might come to your benefit in this episode then. But anyways, the kind of basis behind this episode and why I thought of it is because our lab recruits participants for various studies, and one of the studies involved TMS, which basically is this big magnet that zaps the brain in a non-painful way, and you can get a motor response out of it, so your muscle will respond based on the TMS targeting certain regions of the brain. And so Kyle came on to participate for this study. And during this time, he had a lot of basic neuroscience questions that we don't normally get, because most of the time when we recruit participants, they end up coming from psychology and neuroscience fields. So I thought it would be really fun to ask Kyle some of these questions and kind of explain some of these fun concepts that you learn in your first or second year neuroscience psychology courses. Most of these are just like things that I thought were interesting, so a bit biased, but yeah, that's basically the premise. And then we're going to end today's episode with Kyle's personal experience using motor imagery and rock climbing, which will be fun because you like rock climbing, right?
I do like rock climbing.
Okay.
Well, it's a fun hobby.
Fun hobby, yeah. It's the reason why I rock climb, I would say. But before we get into this episode, I have a couple of first date questions for our new segment called First Date Questions. I came up with the segment title myself. Anyways, so I have a couple questions for you.
For you.
If you could switch lives with any fictional character, who would it be and why?
And why? I'm blanking quite hard. I was giving no prep time, and the why definitely threw me off, so I can't just throw some random name out there.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be your favorite. You're just switching lives with the fictional character, no big deal.
Maybe George Jetson.
Okay, who's that?
He's the father in the cartoon show called The Jetsons.
Okay.
And he has a flying car, okay. And they seem to be able to afford housing.
Ah.
So it's pretty aspirational.
Nice. A flying car and affording housing. I need that. All right. The next question I have for you is, if you could only listen to one song for the rest of your life, what would it be and why?
According to Spotify, it'd be Dancing in the Moonlight by King Harvest.
Yeah, that's a good song.
As of last year. But I don't know, maybe that one. It's a fine song. You can jam to it. You can chill to it.
Mm-hmm.
You can get hyped to Dancing in the Moonlight for sure.
Yeah, I like the top loader version. It's quite good.
It's teach their own.
Yeah, I think my song would be probably Happy Birthday.
Like just what you sing when someone's birthday?
Yeah. It's the only song I can listen to for the rest of my life. Can't disagree.
It's not a...
Actually, you can disagree.
I think I will disagree.
Yeah, I don't actually think it would be. I think I would want it to be something extremely, extremely long. Because if it's the only song that I get to listen to for the rest of my life, then I might as well let it be like a 24-hour long song. I don't know if that exists out there, but
there are definitely YouTube edits of some fun noises that you maybe could hear for 24 hours.
Yeah, no, see, I wouldn't want like the repetition of like the nye, 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 nye. You know that one? Anyways,
do I know Nyan Cat? Yeah.
I wouldn't want that over and over again. I would want something with like a lot of complexity. Like maybe some sort of orchestra piece.
Some sort of
maybe
orchestra piece of like Crocodile Rock, maybe.
Yeah, but like longer, like a 24-hour version. Like maybe a 24-hour version of Taylor Swift's All Too Well.
I'm unfamiliar with the song.
Okay, well, but you know, that was a good joke. I'm patting myself on the back.
Good one.
All right. So moving on from our first date questions, which I don't really know. What do I think based on your responses?
Would you date me?
No.
Fair enough.
All right. So let's get to these neuroscience questions. So yeah, like I said, these are just a random assortment of basic neuroscience and psychology questions that most first year students would have learned in an introductory course. So let's start off simple. Kyle, what is a neuron?
A neuron is a brain cell, I believe.
That is correct. Do you have any more to add to that?
There's like a bunch of different parts to it. There's like the main body, and there's like little tendrily bits that come out from it that'll attach to other neurons. And that's how like some signals get sent back and forth.
Nice.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Something along those lines.
Yeah. So a neuron is, like you said, a brain cell or a nerve cell. And these cells are responsible for sending and receiving messages all over the body. So they allow you to do everything from breathing to talking, eating, walking, and thinking. I came up with this myself.
They let you poop as well?
They probably do. By probably, most definitely.
Yeah, probably. Research needed.
The three basic parts of the neuron, like you said, were the cell body and the little extra bits, the axon and the dendrite. And so these neurons communicate with each other by sending chemicals. Do you know what these chemicals are called?
Brain chemicals?
Yes, are also known as neurotransmitters.
That was my next...
Yes.
Yes, I feel like I shouldn't be getting all this. It's very, very on the spot. I didn't study for the test. I'm sorry.
And so these neurotransmitters are sent across a tiny little space called the synapse. And I don't know if you remember this as well, but we have three kinds of neurons: sensory neurons, motor neurons, and interneurons.
I feel like I should remember those. All of these words are familiar to me.
Yeah.
And it makes me upset that I don't know them.
Don't be upset. We're having fun.
Not knowledge lost to time, I guess.
How old are you? No, I'm just kidding.
I haven't done school in at least a year, so it's all gone.
It's all gone. No, but, you know, you've got a lot of other knowledge in there now, like different spirits from Spirit Island.
Shout out to Spirit Island.
It's a fun game. If you haven't tried, you should definitely invest a lot of money into it. It's worth it.
Yeah, make sure you got like a free 4 hours for your first game, though.
Yeah, 4 to 5 hours. And then plan out at least 4 to 5 hours every week following that, because you'll have so much time. I mean, so much fun.
So much fun, you'll make the time.
You'll make the time, exactly. All right, so next question. Which side of the brain is responsible for moving the left side of your body?
Yeah, the right side of your brain.
Yes, that is correct. So the brain is divided into two parts called hemispheres. And so the right hemisphere of the brain controls the left side of your body and vice versa. So this is kind of fun when doing TMS hot spotting, because we will target the right side of your brain to stimulate a muscle on the left side of your, like in your left hand, basically. But that's only for the left hand people like me. For the most part, we stimulate the left side of the brain, and that has a response in the right hand muscle. So
true. I was there when that happened.
Yeah. Did you feel any like tingly muscle contractions?
I think it was actually part of the experiment, so I hope so.
Yeah. All right, next one. You might not have learned this in your introductory psych class, but what is the motor homunculus?
I've I've gained knowledge after that first experiment I was a part of, and it's this abomination that you make based on the number of sensory stuff in the brain allocated to each body part.
Yeah, that's pretty good. My formal definition doesn't use the word abomination, but basically it's a topographical representation of the body parts and its correspondence along the precentral gyrus of the frontal lobe. Okay, you know, I think I can break down that down a little bit. So the precentral gyrus of the frontal lobe is basically just the location of your motor cortex.
Nice.
And this is the region of the brain that is responsible for communicating information related to movement. So all the neurons code for movement in the motor cortex. And then the topographical representation basically describes what you were saying, which is it's just locations along this precentral gyrus represent certain regions of the body. So on the inside, closer to the top center part of your brain, that region codes for movements of your lower limb. And then as you move outwards, you can code for your body, your arm, your hand, all the way down to the face. But what's interesting about the motor homunculus is that the size of the brain region depends on how often you use that body part. So we use our hands a lot more than we use our feet. So a larger portion of the motor homunculus will code for hand movements than feet movements. And so for you, Kyle, as a rock climber, you probably just have a massive hand region in your motor homunculus because you're using all your little fingers on those rock holds, I think.
That's exactly how it works. Yeah. Yes, you use the fingers to grasp the rock firmly.
Yeah. But no, I'm pretty sure like the distribution of these regions in the motor homunculus is pretty similar across all species.
Does it actually increase based on the amount? Like, if someone had like a creamsicle like every single day for 2 years, would that like increase the size of like their tongue, region of the brain?
That's a really good question. I don't know if I can answer that like with super like a lot of confidence. But what my assumption would be is that like the brain size, like region size that is associated to the tongue, would remain the same size, but the strength of the connections between the neurons in that region would be greater because they're used more. And because I think, again, allegedly, I believe the distribution of like the amount of neurons per each body region is pretty like determined in like your developmental years. So like, you know, I really don't think that it would change all that much. However, I know that there are some studies about like, you know, if you were born blind, then like the vision region of your brain ends up coding from other senses than eyesight. So
that makes sense.
There's probably exceptions to each case, and maybe if you had like started using certain regions of your brain more than the average person before your brain is fully developed, maybe there's a possibility. I don't know.
So you gotta give extra creamsicles while they're still in the womb.
Yes.
Yes, all right.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. So next question. What is I can't even say this word.
Good try.
Synesthesia?
Is it like Anastasia, like the movie?
Please elaborate.
Isn't that a Disney movie called Anastasia? I've never seen it, but
no.
About somebody who sleeps, maybe?
About someone who's anesthesia, like the thing that they use to knock patients out before surgeries.
Yeah, but like different, because I think this is like actually like somebody's name, though.
Oh, okay, yeah. No, that's incorrect. No. Do you have any other guesses? It's called synesthesia.
Probably something to do with, there's a synapse, and that's a connection between two neurons.
Oh, look at you.
So maybe it's a movie about the space between two neurons and a girl who lives there.
That would be like quality movie content. And if it was like a cartoon too, that would be like really cool.
It'd be really fun, yeah. If they made it like seem like realistic, it could be like kind of maybe like some like abomination of like a just some like a man-made horror type thing. It's like, what if we got real close to a neuron and we put somebody on top of it?
It's like putting someone on the moon, I think. Maybe.
Yeah, exactly like that.
All right. So, no, that's incorrect. Synesthesia is when you experience multiple sensations at the same time. So you can think of it as blending of the senses. For example, people who experience synesthesia, they're called synesthetes, may associate letters of the alphabet with specific colors. So, I don't know if you experienced this, but for me...
No, I was going with like getting hit in the face by like a cold fish. That's... What? Because you got like cold and wet, and then you have like force.
Yeah.
No. And maybe smell at the same time.
No, no. Okay. No, this is like the... It's not normal. I don't know if normal is the right word, but like the average human doesn't blend their senses they see colors, right?
I have
heard.
Oh,
wait, we do see colors. When they associate letters of the alphabet with specific colors. To kind of finish off my examples, the other kind of synesthesia that some people experience is when they see colors, when they hear sounds.
See colors and hear sounds?
Yeah, at the same time. And so there are some famous musicians who are known to be synesthetes, including Duke Ellington, Billy Joel, and Billie Eilish. So,
oh, wow.
I know. I think it's really cool. I think it probably helps them be pitch perfect as well, because they can hear the note and see the color. So they know what color is associated with what
note. So sounds have color, and it's not just hear sounds and see color, because I mean I hear sounds and I have my eyes open a lot of the time.
Yeah. I hear sounds and I don't see colors, but like I see colors and I hear sounds, but not at the same time.
Whenever you hear stuff, it's just your vision goes to like the beginning of the Wizard of Oz.
Yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. All right. So moving on from synesthesia, my next question is, who is patient HM?
Is that Typhoid Mary?
No. Who's that?
A woman who was like positive for typhoid, and then they were like, please stop going everywhere. And she just said no. And allegedly, I think she kept going everywhere and infected lots of people, and people died.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Omit my previous laugh from the track. No, that is not patient HM.
HM, like the clothing brand?
That's H and M, I believe.
Oh, tomato, tomato.
Yeah, exactly. No, so patient HM is probably one of the best known patients in neuroscience. So basically, he suffered from many seizures, and to control these seizures, patient HM had a surgery that left him with severe amnesia, or also known as memory loss. Mm-hmm. So he was able to remember some things, such as memories from his childhood, facts about his parents, or even historical events. However, he was unable to make new memories. So this is called anterograde amnesia, whereas retrograde amnesia would be the inability to remember past memories, and anterograde amnesia is the inability to create new memories. So if he were to meet someone, a few minutes later, he would forget that he had ever met them. And so patient HM's loss of making new memories led to some significant findings in learning and memory. So despite the fact that he could not make any new memories, patient HM was able to practice tasks that got better with practice. So he was able to learn new skills, such as like a complex drawing task, despite having no memories of ever practicing them. So what this showed is that we have different types of memory. So patient HM lost his ability to make new explicit memories that require conscious thinking, it's like long-term conscious memories, but his implicit, or also known as procedural memories, stayed intact. So this is a form of unconscious long-term memory that includes things like riding a bike or brushing your teeth.
So like muscle memory type stuff.
Yes, except technically, muscle memory does not exist. That's like a big neuroscience thing.
But if it were to exist, it would include things such as riding a bike and brushing your teeth.
Yeah, so okay. The argument behind muscle memory not existing is basically your muscles themselves are not thought to have any memory, but the brain, that like brain regions that code for those muscle movements, is what has that memory. So anyways, I'm like pretty primed to always respond to anyone saying muscle memory with muscle memory does not exist.
True. Hit them with the actually.
Actually. And that definitely backfired on me one time because there was this Christmas piano concert that my brother hosted in our place in Victoria. And we invited our neighbor, whose name is Betty. And she's quite a bit older than I am and from definitely a different generation. Very lovely person, by the way. She also has a really beautiful garden that is honestly should win awards every year.
Just to let you know that older people are in fact really lovely people sometimes.
Yes. Anyways, she said something about muscle memory at some point while like talking about like Luke's, my brother, who's doing the piano performance, is like, oh, you know, it's so impressive that you have all this muscle memory. And then I just like fired back, like, muscle memory does not exist.
You dunked on her and you sent her home crying.
And then she just like looked at me like super confused, uninterested in what I just said, like doesn't really want to hear the explanation. And everyone is now looking at me and I'm just like, I regret saying it. I really do. So yeah, but anyways, muscle memory does not exist. And yeah, so for all you people out there who say that, just remember, it's actually, what word would I use instead of muscle memory?
Yeah, how would you describe muscle memory if it's not muscle memory?
I would just say memory of movements, maybe.
Memory of movements.
Yeah, really easy to just throw into a sentence, I think.
That's a good one.
Yeah, so anyways.
Memory of muscle movements, maybe. Probably shorten that down a bit, get rid of a couple of words there.
Yeah, maybe like muscle memory.
That might work for now.
You know what? Yeah.
We'll use it as a placeholder.
Yeah, just a placeholder. But anyways, yeah, so patient HM could not remember making new muscle memories, but he did in fact have this unconscious long-term memory preserved after his surgery. So
what were those two different types again?
So there is what we call implicit or procedural memories, which are the unconscious ones, or explicit memories.
No, the like the time specific.
Oh, like the amnesia stuff?
Yeah, I guess.
There's two types of amnesia. You've got retrograde amnesia, which is the inability to remember past memories, and anterograde amnesia, which is the inability to make new memories. So that kind of concludes my basic neuroscience questions. I really didn't think you were gonna get a lot of them right.
I'm hurt, but I'll survive.
So I'm also like quite impressed, especially for Kyle that I met on the street who just rock climbs. So anyways, but there are plenty more topics that we could cover, so if you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to let me know and we will have Kyle back to answer some more fun questions. But as alluded to at the beginning of this episode, Kyle, before we go, I do want to chat more about one topic. So I think it would be an understatement to say that you like climbing, correct?
I think that's like a statement. I think that's a fine statement.
A fine statement, yeah. So what's really cool about rock climbing in particular is that it is a sport that uses motor imagery. And, you know, if you've been a longtime listener, by now you probably know what motor imagery is. But for those of you who have just tuned in today's episode, motor imagery is the imagination of movement or the mental rehearsal of a movement. So it's basically just imagining yourself doing action. And so I know that most high performance athletes use motor imagery as part of their practice. But the reason why I think climbing is so unique is that you almost use motor imagery every time you climb. And most of the time, it's unknowingly. So I would say, like, high-performance athletes have, like, a really cool training coach. And the coach will tell them, like, to mentally rehearse their actions and stuff. But in rock climbing, even as a beginner rock climber, you just end up doing it naturally. So I think it's a great real-life example of using motor imagery. So Kyle, can you describe for our listeners? I think, like, we should have maybe, like, a little bit of a breakdown about what rock climbing is and like things that you think about when you climb and how you use it. And that's Kyle for you.
Excuse me.
That should have been a part of your
intro.
Yeah,
it's on an on-demand thing. You gotta let them cook, you know.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. But anyways, back to rock climbing. Do you want to give us a little bit of an overview
about what rock climbing is?
Yeah, about rock climbing and
sure. So rock climbing, we'll go with indoor rock climbing because there's like two different styles. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, indoor and outdoor. Outdoor being you're climbing actual cliff faces or large boulders like glacial erratics.
Glacial erratics,
which is what we have a lot of here in Nova Scotia. Especially yeah. Around a Peggy's Cove. And so outside, it's you have like really small holds and small stuff a lot of the time to work with. So in order to climb rocks. And then indoors, there's lots of very colorful holds that they put all over the wall. So it's really easy to see where your next hold or goal is you need to get to.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that, maybe.
Yeah. And so, like, in the gym, they mm-hmm. have different colored holds, and, like, it differs across, like, different climbing gyms that you go to.
The grades.
And then same with the grades, but at least at the climbing gym here in Halifax, and also in Victoria, for anyone who's listening from Victoria, they basically, like, the hold color doesn't really matter in terms of the grades, but the tape color that they have, so they have, like, starting hand holds and fit holds. Foot holds, where it's like your starting position. You start your hands on like two different ones and your feet on two different ones. Mm-hmm. And then they have tape at the top of the climb that indicates like the end of the climb. And so here in Halifax, they have, I think it goes yellow, then orange, green, blue, purple, red, black, pink. That sounds right.
Yep.
And the grade of the climb indicates the difficulty. So yellow is the easiest, pink is the hardest. Well,
white maybe being easiest, but it's like a ladder up the wall.
Yeah. White is like a staircase. No, I'm just kidding. But
you have something for everyone, though, so yeah. Everyone can have fun.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a really difficult sport. I would say, how long have I been doing it? About like 4 months, and I'm happily climbing greens. So, and how long have you been climbing, Kyle?
I've been climbing for, what month is it? April?
Yeah.
A year and 4 months-ish.
And
3 months.
Where would you say you're on this like scale?
On the grand scale of climbing, I think above average. I think I'm an above average climber.
And what color would you associate yourself with?
Comfortably maybe reds when I'm healthy.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So you start getting into some smaller holds around then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Instead of like big big comfy jugs.
Which is what I like to climb on. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing is that, like, I have quite small hands. I don't know.
Very small hands.
Yeah, it's one of my distinguishing features because I would say I'm like an average height of 5'6", but my hands are.
Are you?
I think so. Yeah, I'm 5'6". I don't know what you're questioning, whether I'm average height or.
You can say it with confidence, though.
Okay, so I'm 5'6", but I have hands the size of someone who's about 5 foot.
I think it's like 5 years old.
No. Anyways, I know my friend Simone, my best friend Simone, who's, I don't know if she's even 5 foot, but she
Don't do her dirty.
But she's got about the same size hands as me. Anyways, the point is that these jugs that you're referring to, so they're just like big things that you can just grasp. They're like really comfy.
Big comfy holds. You can get all of your fingers behind the hold. Yeah. They're very, very positive hold. So there's lots of in-cut in the back of them. So your fingers will go down when they wrap around it.
Yeah, and they feel very safe. You don't feel like you're going anywhere. They sit in, like, the center of my palm. So I end up having, like, a callus in the middle of my hand, whereas Kyle has never had a callus there in his life. So
I'm just not climbing hard enough.
Yeah, maybe you're not climbing hard enough, but anyways, that's kind of unreal.
You seem to grab jugs properly then.
Yeah, apparently you can grab them with just your fingertips, but my fingers are so small. Anyways, more back to the motor imagery part. Do you want to maybe chat on how you use imagining of movements to help you with climbing?
Yeah, so with bouldering, it's usually shorter climbs, higher intensity, and the root setters usually set it's called like a boulder problem is what we'll usually refer to it as. And so you have to be like strong enough to do it, but you also need to figure out how to move your body in such a way. Because it's like, sure, there are climbs you can make that are like really burly and you seem to like hold on. And if you don't have any technique, then you'll just be like farted off the wall and then you'll start crying.
I've only cried a few times.
only a few times.
Yeah.
But yeah, for like more technical climbs, then you might need to, like, you'll give it a shot and then you'll fall off and then you'll be like, what do I need to do differently? And then, like, for me, like, I'll go through the movements on the ground of, like, what I'm going to be doing, like, my hands and my feet, and then try and set myself up better next time.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if, like, you need, like, that tight coordination and you have to, like, certain things have to happen in a certain order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, the thing that really took my attention is, like, Kyle and I, even though I just met him, we like to spend a lot of our free time watching climbing videos. And there was this one video that you were showing me. I can't remember who was climbing in it, but they did this really small movement where they put their thumb on the hold in a very specific location and then took it off and replaced it in another location on the same hold. And that small movement of their thumb made all the difference to keep themselves on the wall. I don't know if you remember it. It's like this little, I can remember what it looks like in my head, but
you can remember this person's thumb.
Yeah, it's just like this little like spray wall video that you were showing me.
Yeah, I need more than at some point there's a person lot. And the person had at least one thumb. And
yeah, so when you imagine yourself doing the climbs, mm-hmm. do you ever imagine yourself making mistakes?
I mean, no, not usually.
You're like really thinking about placing it correctly.
Yeah, I'm thinking about how to do it. I mean, if you fall off, then like you'll go through the movements, and if you find that you're in, that you've like, while you're picturing what you're doing, that you find yourself like ending up in the exact same spot, then you can like back step like one hand movement or one foot movement and then make a change and then be like, okay, this might fix the error that happened. And then your next go, you can try that and see if it works.
Right. So you're like kind of imagining your next move to make a correction for something that you did wrong in the last go.
Yeah. If you messed up the last go.
If you messed up the last go. Yeah. And for those people who, again, don't climb, if you flash a boulder problem, that means that you got it on your first try. And so I can confidently say I flashed a lot of yellows and oranges.
Crushing it.
Yeah, crushing it. And yeah, that's really easy grades. But
yeah, I feel like most people listening could probably do a yellow pretty easily. It's quite comfy on the hands, just kind of a walk up the wall. But it's do you trust your hands?
Yeah. I mean, I would say I trust my hands. The thing that I struggled with a lot at the beginning was my fear of heights. And I don't have that as much anymore. Like, I'm still terrified of heights. And there was a climb that we did together, like, a few weeks ago that I was just terrified the entire time. But it not so much at the lower levels anymore, so... That's good. But for the most part, if you bring someone climbing for the first time, they should be able to complete some yellows and feel good about themselves.
Mm-hmm. Some V0s. If your easiest tape color isn't yellow.
I know in the UK, yellow is like one of the harder levels, at least in the London locations. I only know that because I watch Hannah Morris's YouTube videos a lot. Nice. So, yeah. Not just Hannah Morris. You know, I'm not going to go and tell the ones that I watch. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. So, it is really cool. And there's a really interesting YouTube documentary on one of the best sport climbers, I think.
You're talking about Adam Andra?
Adam Andra.
good argument for him being the best sport climber.
Yeah.
Pretty good argument for that.
Anyways, Kyle, do you want to describe the difference between sport climbing and bouldering?
So bouldering is usually like the shorter routes, but like more powerful moves.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually don't go too high, and your fall protection is a mat that you place on the ground that you mm-hmm. carry to the spot. Sport climbing is usually, this is like big generalizations here, but it's usually longer and maybe slightly less intense, but like more endurance focused. And this is the climbing that you would do up like a cliff, and like as you're going, you're like dragging the rope up and you're clipping into your safety, whether that stuff is bolted in, or if maybe you're doing like some traditional climbing and you're placing your own protection, which I don't do because that's crazy.
Yeah, Kyle is known in our climbing friend group. Sorry, did I say that we were friends? Anyways, in our climbing friend group, he's known to really enjoy bouldering and not so much all the heavy equipment associated with
all the rope stuff. No, not for me.
Yeah, I don't think I'm experienced enough to have a preference, but I'm way scared of heights, so the rope stuff gets really scary sometimes.
Yeah, you fall less with the rope stuff, though.
You do fall less, and so the fear of heights really...
Or the distance you fall isn't as... You might fall the same amount, but the distance you fall is less.
Yes, yeah, that's true. I understand what you're saying mm-hmm. now, but... Yeah, so Adam Andra is the best sport climber in the world, and he has a film out on YouTube that you guys can go search up. It's called Silence, and he uses a lot of motor imagery. And in sport, it's mostly called visualization, so they might refer to it as that, but basically... I think he had like a period of time where he was sick and couldn't physically practice his moves. And this was where imagery became really, really important, because he was about to embark on one of the world's hardest lead ropes.
It's currently the hardest and the only one graded as such.
And so he practiced these moves over and over and over again until he got sick. And then he was only able to practice with motor imagery. But as you watch through the film, there's a lot of really inspiring parts throughout it. Like, he builds his own climbing gym dedicated to the specific moves that this climb has. But yeah, so he is known to be like a huge user of motor imagery in a lot of his practice. And it's very, very cool because A, it shows the potential and the power of motor imagery, and B, it shows people using it not just at high levels, but also at my level. So I think it's really cool. And do you have any other final remarks, Kyle, about climbing, motor imagery, anything really?
I don't think I have anything too specific. I mean, I'll pay attention to the motor imagery that I use in climbing when I go later today.
Yeah. I think it can be a cool thing, because one of the things I would say the majority of rock climbers are kind of, I don't know if scared is the right word, but kind of cautious about is injury. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of rock climbing specific injuries. And I think someone who's unfamiliar with the sport would assume that's like a broken arm or broken leg because you're like falling all the time. But for the most part, climbers fall in very controlled manners, so the likelihood of that happening is very low. The more typical types of injuries that you see with rock climbing would be overuse injuries. And I know when I first started, I felt like kind of a little bit of pain in like my inner elbow, and that's kind of where all your forearm flexors attach to. And so this was a really good indicator that I was over gripping on the wall because I was so scared of letting go. And so that's more of like a beginner injury, I would say. I think more advanced injuries are kind of like the pulleys in your fingers. I know you're currently kind of rehabbing
a finger. Yeah, injury. A bit of both my middle fingers, a bit upsetty spaghetti. Yeah. When I pull quite hard sometimes, so we're taking care of those guys. Yeah.
And so if you're thinking about taking up climbing, my biggest piece of advice is don't go every day.
True. That's a good piece of advice.
It's as much as climbing is really fun, your skin and your muscles will thank you, because I do not believe the ligaments and tendons in our hands were meant to be supporting our body weights at such intensities. I mean, you know,
go back to being monk.
Yeah. A monk or a monkey?
Monk mode. As monk in mode. Like monkey.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, but anyways, my point with motor imagery in that is just that when you do find yourself in a situation where you feel yourself maybe nearing an injury, you have an injury, you can use motor imagery to rehab it, which is very cool. But you can also use it to kind of stay with your sport during that time that you have to take off of it. You know, like you can, like Adam Audra, you can imagine yourself doing these hard climbs, and that's still really effective for your rock climbing experience. So I think that's really cool. And the fact that he has like a section dedicated to it in his film Silence, I think makes it worth going to go watch if you haven't seen it already. This is not sponsored by Adam Audra. But, you know, if he wants to sponsor me or La Sportiva or Scarpa. Do you think they're listening to this, Kyle?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely reach out to me, and I will get back to you almost immediately, probably. Anyways, but thank you so much, Kyle, for coming on today's podcast to answer some basic neuroscience questions and to talk a lot about rock climbing, which is really cool.
My pleasure.
Up next, Hudson's Hot Take of the Week.
Do you put cereal in the bowl first or milk? The correct answer is neither, because cereal is better without milk. Unless you wolf it down, milk makes cereal soggy and takes away from the crunchiness of the cereal until you're left with nothing but a starchy paste. Milk can often overpower the flavor of the cereal, making it harder to taste its individual flavors. Who would ever want to speed eat Lucky Charms? At that point, grow up and eat granola or overnight oats or some actual complete breakfast. Cereal is meant to be eaten dry by the handful and only ever as a quick snack.
Well, thank you for listening to our podcast, Mind the Gap. I am your host, Juliet.
And I am your co-host, Teresa.
And this was recorded at CKDU.